It's a Charlie Brown day. There's a painting in my office called Charlie Brown.
Yeah?
Doesn't look like Charlie Brown at all.
That's weird.
Yeah, it is. Hey there!
Hi, Fran.
Hi, friends. How's it going?
It's going. My eyes are kind of dry.
It's like that kind of year, I feel like. That time of year.
It's that kind of year.
It's also that kind of year.
It's dry eye year.
Dry eyes. Clean them up with... Have you seen that video?
No.
They're old commercials. It's that guy who's got most really boring, low voice, and he's like got really red, droopy eyes. He's like, dry eyes.
Oh my God.
Have you ever seen these?
I mean, I don't know.
Oh my God, you've totally seen them.
Not that I recall, but...
They were on TV all the time when we were growing up.
Okay.
So anyway, I'm dying.
Who are you?
I'm Emily. Who are you?
And you're dying.
I'm Emily, and everything hurts, and I'm dying.
Aren't we all, though?
I mean, yeah.
Hi, I'm Marguerite.
Not that I asked. Virginia. Sorry.
And we're Millennial Poet Society.
I just burped really big. I'm sorry. Hi. What do we do here?
We talk about our lives and talk about poets and poetry and somehow intertwine them.
Sometimes it's a little sloppy, but most of the time it's pretty good.
I was about to say seamlessly, but I guess not.
Sometimes it's seamless. Most of the time it's seamless. There are days. Mm-hmm. It's not your fault. It's usually my fault.
I mean, I don't know about that.
I'm a pretty choppy kind of person. Chop, chop.
Chop, chop. What's today?
Today is a very special episode, listeners. Can you guess why? Probably you can by the number of episodes we've put out, but today is our 30th episode.
So old.
The big 3-0. It's a pretty special day. We've been doing this for 30 weeks now.
For over half a year.
Which is pretty intense.
Yeah.
And so, happy birthday.
Happy.
Marguerite. Thanks. MPS.
A happy birthday, Emily.
Thank you.
We're 30, flirty, and thriving.
We are 30, flirty, and thriving.
Oh my God, your eyes got so big.
Because I love that movie. 13 Going on 30 is an excellent movie. I don't care what you say.
I didn't say anything.
We've been doing this. You're right. You didn't say anything. But we've been doing this podcast for 30 weeks now, which is really cool. But in case you were wondering, here are some other things that are turning 30 this year. The Nintendo Game Boy.
Oh my God.
Do you all remember those?
Oh my God. I had a Game Boy Color or whatever.
Did you?
Yeah.
I didn't have any of them.
One of the ones that was like the clear sort of like
whatever. Yeah. It was like the see-through one.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That was so cool. I never had one, but I had friends who had them and I would play them on the bus.
Mine was like a hand-me-down from my cousin, I think. I got it sort of at the tail end of when they were like cool to have. I think I had like two games.
Well, they came out like 5 years before we were born. So.
Yeah.
By the time we were playing them, they were pretty much like solid in the toy game, you know?
Switches are the thing now, right?
Switches are the thing.
Are they fun?
I've played on a couple. They're not bad.
No?
There are some games I
Should
like.
Should I get one?
No. Are you a hardcore gamer?
No.
Then probs not. I mean, do you...
Probs not.
Do you see yourself like... pulling it out on the subway and, like, playing games?
Oh, I always pull it out on the subway.
Okay, but... I think we're getting into some dangerous territory, and maybe I should move on to number 2 on my list.
What's that?
The Little Mermaid.
It's turning 30?
As of November 17th, The Little Mermaid will be 30 years old. It debuted in 1989 on November 17th, and it grossed, like... $200 million, which was a lot back then for movies.
Wow.
So, that's...
Ariel's killing it.
Ariel is killing it. She's still so relevant today.
Oh, yeah. 30, everyone knows 40. Who Little Mermaid is.
Except one of my podmates at work. She, like, didn't know. She has a kid, too. She was like,
what?
She was like, yeah, I didn't grow up with them. And now when my daughter has watched them, she just says... Mom, why does she need a man to save her? And I'm like, oh, I love this child also. And she's right. But the princesses are like a staple in every childhood, yeah, regardless of gender.
When it's also like, even if you don't know the Little Mermaid, does she know like the Grimm's fairy tale version?
She didn't even know the names of the princesses. She was like, who is Aurora? Who is Aurora?
I mean, Aurora is one of the more like not.
But I was like, can you name two other princesses? And she was like, is Mulan a princess? And I was like, no, and that's problematic. But no, I mean.
But she's a Disney female character.
Yeah, but she didn't know like Belle or Cinderella. Or
where'd she grow up?
Snow White. I don't know, Jersey.
That's why.
All right. Next is the love song. Or I'm sorry, the song Love Shack by the B-52s.
Oh my God.
Turning 30.
Oh my God. My first, my only karaoke machine that I ever got.
My very first karaoke machine.
My first karaoke machine. My only karaoke machine that I got came with like a sample track or like a couple of sample songs. And that one was, like, on there.
Love Shack.
And so I would, like, be in my room, like, singing, like, Love Shack.
Oh, my God. I was 10 root. Rusty. Oh, my God.
I was, like, I don't even know how old I was. I should not have been singing that song. I did not know what it meant.
I don't understand karaoke machines. I didn't have one as a kid. And I don't understand them.
It's mine wasn't, it didn't have like a screen where it played the words for you. It just played music and it had a microphone that plugged into it and you got to sing along. It was like basically just an amplifier for the microphone. And then you put CDs in.
I can totally picture you singing into your microphone alone in your bedroom, just being like, Love Shack! Oh my God!
That's exactly how it was.
That's really cute.
Because I was also like the only CD that I had at the time.
Right.
Until I got like all my brothers NSYNC and 90 Degrees hand-me-downs.
I want to apologize to my parents now. I know they liked NSYNC, I guess, or at least they really pretended to, because they sat through many, many a bedroom concert of mine, singing all of NSYNC's discography at the time. Yeah. Nice. Anyway.
Is that all our facts?
No, there's two more. Three more. Real quick.
That's fine.
The Simpsons is turning 30.
Wow.
I know. Tim Burton's original Batman movie is turning 30.
Wow.
Sadly, Tim Burton is not turning 30.
No.
Still 29. God bless
him. That'd be crazy if he was turning 30 and he also had a movie out that was turning 30.
He was like, 30. I made this in my mother's womb.
In the womb. Literally the womb. Just rolled out and was like, make it.
I mean, honestly, probably. I don't put it past him.
Oh my God.
And then last but not least, Baywatch.
Ah!
Is turning the big 3-0.
Baywatch.
Pretty exciting
stuff.
What was
their song?
Oh, I have no idea.
Oh, it was like the famous song that they like ran down the beach to.
All I can think of is the Rocky theme right now.
That's.
I know that's not it.
Not it.
That's not
it.
What's
the Rocky
theme? That's not the Rocky theme.
What is it? That's like.
Dun 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 dun. Ba-da-ba, ba-da-ba.
That's the part that I was trying to think of, but I didn't. I was doing the final countdown.
Yeah, that's all right.
Great.
Okay,
well,
cool.
Happy 30 weeks to us.
Happy 30 weeks.
Happy 30 weeks. And
I'm sorry. Marguerite has so much hair, as we've covered in past episodes. And she's got it in this nice braid right now, but she's got it pulled up over the top of her head in front of her face, and she's just, like, petting it like a mad woman. She's like, yes.
She's like a cat.
Yes. Episode 30. Here we go. Amazing. Shall we get started with some poetry?
Well, yeah. First, though, let me talk about our Who's to Say episode.
Oh, yeah.
So we do these episodes called Who's to Say, and they are our mini episodes. We just finished season one a few weeks ago, and in those episodes we talk about and share the work of unpublished or self-published poets so that we can share their work. All of you can listen to it, share it with your friends and family, go follow them on Instagram, all those fun things, give them some love. We love talking about poets that, like, throughout history and modern poets and everything like that are well-known, But also it's really important to support the folks who don't have as big a platform as others and
right.
give them a platform and people who listen. So if you are someone who falls under the category of unpublished or self-published, and when we say unpublished, we mean unpublished in terms of a collection or that sort of thing. So if you've been published, you've had a couple poems published in like different
magazines,
publications,
or...
yeah, where it's like you have a single poem or that sort of thing, we still want your work and we want to share it. And then once you do publish a collection, let us know and we'll give you some props. But yeah, so send us your work to millennialpoetssociety@gmail.com. You can find that email address in the show notes right under this episode, or you can also find it on our Instagram or Facebook. So on Facebook, search Millennial Poet Society.
You'll see our cute little pink logo.
Yep, you'll see our millennial pink logo. Or on Instagram, you can search MPS_podcast. You'll find us there. Give us a follow, like some of our stuff, maybe have a watch on our story if we've got something going on that day. And then click either the contact or the email button that is under our bio, and that'll pull up a blank email for you to go ahead and put some of your work in there. Tell us a little bit about yourself and send it on over so that we can consider you for our season 2 of Who's to Say.
Yay.
Yeah, send it on over. So yeah, now we can start. Now we can start.
It's your turn to start.
My turn to start. Yay. We've got a long one today. All right. So we're talking about the Harlem Renaissance, the 1930s to the 1940s. So during this time period, so again, a lot of this stuff, pretty much all of it is coming from the Poetry Foundation, both my info about this time period of the Harlem Renaissance, as well as my information on my poet. So a little bit about this time period. By the 1930s, unemployment and municipal neglect had transformed Harlem. So we had been in this time period where there was a lot of growth and a lot of really positive things happening at the time. And so now we're like post or within the Great Depression, all of that. So it's a little bit more of a hard time for everyone. Though scholars hold differing views as to when the Harlem Renaissance ended, some point to the Harlem race riot of 1935 as a bookend to the movement. When rumors circulated that police had murdered a black Puerto Rican teenager for stealing a 10-cent pocket knife from a local store, more than 10,000 people took to the streets in Harlem. Mm. The protests soon turned violent and resulted in 3 deaths, 125 arrests, and more than $2 million in property damage.
Wow.
Yeah. Other economic factors brought changes to Harlem, and many residents moved away from the area. Poets from the Harlem Renaissance left an immeasurable impact on modern and contemporary poetry, inspiring the Black arts movement of the 1960s and 70s, as well as international art movements of the African diaspora, known as Negroism in the Caribbean and Negritude in the Francophone world. Mm-hmm. So, it's a little bit about that time period and sort of the wrapping up of the Harlem Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
With that, we are going to talk about James Weldon Johnson,
okay,
who was a very prominent figure during the time. I was telling Emily earlier, when I was trying to decide who to do this week, I was like, I won't do Langston Hughes because I don't want it to be too long. And I want to I also wanted to save him for some time when, I don't know, just I wanted to save him. So I was like, we'll do James Weldon Johnson. Like, I definitely know the name and that sort of thing, but I feel like maybe it won't be quite as extensive as if I were to do like Langston Hughes.
Right.
Boy, was I wrong. So much information. I feel like there's a lot that I left out. I tried to narrow it down a little bit. There's stuff about his political background and like his novel and all this stuff that I left out just because I needed to sort of skim things down a little bit to fit it in here, but maybe we'll come back to him sometime.
Wow.
He was born in 1871 in Jacksonville, Florida, and was brought up in a relatively tolerant southern town, which may explain his later political moderation. Both his father and his mother had lived in the North and had never been enslaved. He and his brother, John Rosamond, grew up in a broadly cultured and economically secure surroundings, that were unusual among Southern black families at the time, especially like we talked about in earlier episodes with the Harlem Renaissance, like a lot of people left the South to sort of escape the hardships that they had. So they had a relatively, for the time, cultured and economically secure, like, upbringing. Mm-hmm. Again, that's all relative to the time and whatnot.
Sure.
His mother stimulated his early interest in reading, drawing, and music, and he attended the segregated school where she taught until eighth grade. He only attended until eighth grade because high schools were closed to African Americans in Jacksonville.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So Johnson left home to attend secondary school and college at Atlanta University, where he got his bachelor's degree in 1894.
Good for him.
Yeah.
That would have been probably way too easy to just say, I'm done,
mm-hmm.
and not further his education.
Yeah, well, and good on his parents, too. I mean, clearly his mother was someone who, like, valued education and the education of her children and everything. So, it was during his time in college that he truly became aware of the depth of the racial problem in the United States, which, can happen, especially if he was in an area that was a little bit more, like, not quite as bad as other southern areas, him then sort of leaving that, like, sort of protected area of where he grew up. It's going to open your eyes a bit. Race questions were vigorously debated on campus, and Johnson's experience teaching black school children in a poor district of rural Georgia during two summers deeply impressed him with the need to improve the lives of his people. These realizations and new goals influenced his writing at the time. He returned to Jacksonville in 1894 and was appointed a teacher and principal of the Stanton School, which is where he had attended.
Wow.
And he managed to expand the curriculum to include high school level classes for the African American students.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Which is just like,
wow.
The early start of a very, like, he was very involved in civil rights and that sort of thing.
Wow.
He became an active local spokesman on black social and political issues. And in 1895, he founded the Daily American, which was the first black-oriented daily newspaper in the U.S. During its brief life, it only lasted for about a year, the paper became a voice against racial injustice and served to encourage black advancement through individual effort. The following year for lack of readership, but Johnson's ambitious efforts attracted the attention of prominent black leaders of the time, such as W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington.
Wow.
Yeah. Meanwhile, he read law with the help of a local white lawyer, and in 1898, he became the first black lawyer admitted to the Florida bar since Reconstruction.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He was doing all this stuff. Yeah. He practiced law in Jacksonville for several years in partnership with a former Atlanta University classmate while continuing to serve as school principal. So he was doing school principal, education, law, like all this stuff.
He was like, I can do it all.
Everything. He also continued to write poetry and discovered his gift for songwriting, working with his brother Rosamond, a talented composer. So he was also writing music. all his free time.
Jesus.
Among other songs, he penned the lyrics to Lift Every Voice and Sing, a tribute to black endurance, hope, and religious faith that was later adopted by the NAACP and dubbed the Negro National Anthem.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Holy that was him. All of this. Him. Yep. This guy.
He's like, first this, first that, first now this.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. My God.
He left Jacksonville in 1901 after growing tired of its quote-unquote provincialism, which just makes me think of...
There must be more than this provincial life.
And he hopped on up to New York City.
one of your poets is actually having to do with New York City.
Yes,
that's great.
He actually ended up in New York City. He grew tired of Jacksonville's provincialism, but also the mounting incidents of racism there. So he was starting to see the area where he grew up sort of be affected by all of this as well.
Sure.
So he moved with his brother to New York City to quote-unquote seek their fortune writing songs for musical theater.
Aww.
They secured a publishing contract in partnership with Bob Cole that paid a monthly stipend, and over the next 5 years, they composed some 200 songs for Broadway and other musical productions, including Under the Bamboo Tree, The old flag never touched the ground.
The drown.
And didn't he ramble? The trio.
Yes, the old classic. Didn't he ramble?
The old classic, yeah.
I bet you one of our professors would know.
Would know it. Jaswell.
Yeah. That's exactly who.
So the trio avoided writing for racially. I was trying to write a word. I think exploitative was the word that I was trying to write. But they avoided writing for racially sort of for the minstrel shows, right, which, I mean, right. We learned a lot about, or I at yeah. least learned a lot about, yeah, in
American musical theater history.
Yeah, American musical theater history and just like our classes. I remember I learned it through one of my dance classes too, actually. Mm-hmm, we learned a lot about different dance types and everything and the development of jazz. So, yeah, minstrel shows are, especially, like, blackface is used very often, and there's right. a lot of, like, caricature stereotypes that are presented of African-Americans and whatnot. So they avoided writing for those types of shows, but did often find themselves being obliged to present a simplified and stereotyped images of rural black life to suit white audiences. But they also produced works like the six-song suite titled The Evolution of Ragtime, that helped document and expose important black musical idioms. So they sort of had to do a little bit of both and play like the game of the time and be like, all right, this is what the audiences that are going to the theater and have the money to go to the theater right. are going to do. But because of our success with that, it gives us then the platform to do these other things.
Right.
So during this time, he also studied creative literature formally for 3 years at Columbia University. So he's the ultimate multitasker.
Yeah, he's like, I'm going to write some songs, I'm going to study law, uh-huh. I'm going to be a professor, and then I'm also going to get this other degree.
And I'm going to go to Columbia, yeah. So he studied creative literature formally for 3 years at Columbia University and became active in politics.
Because he wasn't busy enough.
Right. He served as a treasurer. He served as treasurer of New York's Colored Republican Club in 1904 and helped write 2 songs for Teddy Roosevelt's presidential campaign.
What?
Yeah.
No.
The black civil rights leadership split into conservative and radical factions backed by Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, respectively. Mm-hmm. And Johnson backed Washington for the most part, who then in turn played an important part in getting the Roosevelt administration to appoint Johnson as U.S. consul in Puerto Cabello, Venezuela, in 1906.
Booker was the radical or conservative?
Booker was the conservative and W.E.B. Du Bois was the radical, so I thought.
Okay.
Yeah. But he still maintained, he especially like earlier on in his political career, he leaned more towards like Washington's sort of ideals and everything, or ideologies and whatnot, but he still maintained a good relationship with both.
Sure.
And a little bit later on in his career, he sort of moved a little bit in the other direction, but still, again, like, again,
his, he like, stayed base in camp was with Booker.
Yeah. 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 Cool. So yeah. So then he ended up in Venezuela in 1906. And his new official duties, he had few official duties and was able to devote much of his time writing poetry, including the acclaimed sonnet Mother Night that was published in the Century magazine and later included in his verse collection 50 Years and Other Poems. Mm. So from what it sounded like during his time there, he basically just was able to like hang out in this beautiful like South American port and write.
Oh, God, such a hard life.
Yeah. And while in that sleepy port town, he also finished his novel, The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. It was published anonymously and attracted little attention until it was reissued under Johnson's own name more than a decade later. Mm. Even then, though, it drew more comment as a sociological document than as a work of fiction. And so many readers believed it to truly be autobiographical that Johnson eventually wrote his real-life story titled Along This Way, to avoid confusion, because it was not an autobiography.
Even though he called it an autobiography.
Yeah, it's just the title of the book, The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. And again, there's a lot of really interesting commentary about the book, and it's a very interesting concept for the novel, but I just didn't have time to get into it.
Sure.
But in 1909, before autobiography had been published, Johnson was promoted to the consular post in Cornito, Nicaragua, a position that proved considerably more demanding than his previous job and left little time for his writing. Mm. It was part of what factored into it being more demanding is that during his 3-year term in this role, it was a period of intense political turmoil in Nicaragua, which culminated in the landing of U.S. troops at Cornito in 1912. Mm-hmm. So, turbulent time while he was there. He then resigned from his post in 1913, seeing little future for himself under President Woodrow Wilson's Democratic administration. And he returned to New York to become an editorial writer for the New York Age, the city's oldest and most distinguished black newspaper. During this period, while he was back in New York writing for the New York Age, he continued to, quote-unquote, indulge his literary love. Having mastered the Spanish language in the diplomatic service, he translated Ferdinando Perique's opera, Goyescas, into English, and the Met Opera produced his libretto version in 1915.
Wow.
He did so fucking much.
He's just,
much.
Like, casually He's killing it.
All over the place. And yeah.
I've never heard of him. I mean, like, I've heard of him, yeah. but, like, you don't yeah, yep. learn about him.
Right. Yeah, you don't.
It's so unfortunate.
You don't. Yeah. He then published his first verse collection in 1917, 50 Years and Other Poems. We mentioned it earlier.
This is first one. So he, this is first one. Just now in 1917.
His first collection that he published. Yeah. He had had other, like, he'd been working on things, right. but he hadn't published a full collection
right.
until 1917.
Wow. Well, he was busy doing yeah. other things.
He had a few other things going on, a few things on his plate. In 1916, just before that, he was urged by Dubois and accepted the newly created post of National Field Secretary for the NAACP, which had grown to become the country's premier black rights advocacy and defense organization since its founding in 1910.
Hmm. Ever heard of it?
his duties included investigating racial incidents and organizing new NAACP branches around the country. And he succeeded in significantly raising the organization's visibility and membership through the years following World War I. In 1917, the same year that his first collection came out, he organized and led a well-publicized silent march through the streets of New York City to protest lynchings and his on-site investigation of abuses committed by American Marines against black citizens of Haiti during the U.S. occupation of that Caribbean nation in 1920. This captured headlines and helped launch a congressional probe into the matter. Johnson's in-depth report, which was published by The Nation magazine in a 4-part series titled Self-Determining Haiti, that there was no end to that sentence.
Great.
But that's...
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the end of the sentence is, like, I have it separated. Because I have a question to ask. Do you know who Warren Harding is?
Yeah. Warren G. Harding.
Who was he?
He was a president?
He was.
Yeah.
He was the 29th president.
He's very yes. important, Gregory.
Very.
It's probably actually very. Not. I don't know.
I mean, this time period was very, like,
so he was whatever. President in, like, 1919.
Yeah.
Or so. So when my grandma was born,
That's probably. Fucking crazy.
100 years ago.
That's so old. I know. Oh my God.
Gosh,
okay.
Amazing.
So the end of that sentence came after that question.
Yes, I know who Warren G.
So great. Congrats to you. Mm-hmm. I did not, or it had left my brain for more important things to fit in there. So this in-depth report that he wrote also impacted the presidential race that year.
In 16, probably.
Well, no. So it was the time that this happened where the Marines were committing, like, crimes against the Haitians was in 1920.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
So,
100 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fucking crazy.
That's insane.
A century ago.
Oh, God.
So this report that he wrote impacted the presidential race that year. Helping to shift public sentiment from the environment, from the interventionist policies associated with the Wilson Democrats toward the more isolationist position of the Republican victor, Warren Harding.
Warren G. Harding.
Warren G. Harding. Great. So he was, like, influencing presidential campaigns, basically.
He's
like
intense.
It's crazy. So his successes as the, like, field secretary led to his appointment as the executive secretary for the NAACP in 1920, which he then held that position for 10 years. During this decade marked an important turning point for the Black Rights Movement, as the NAACP and other organizations sought to defend and expand the social and economic gains the Black community had achieved during the war years, when large numbers of them had migrated to the northern cities and found industrial and manufacturing jobs. The Harlem Renaissance and that whole, the Great Migration, all of that. Even with the heavy demands of his role in the NAACP, the 1920s were a period of literary productivity for Johnson, and because he does everything.
He doesn't slow down.
And earned him critical acclaim in 1922 for editing a seminal collection of Black verse titled The Book of American Negro Poetry.
Wow.
Which I think I mentioned in one of my earlier episodes. His critical introduction to this volume provided new insights into the often ignored and denigrated genre, and is now considered a classic analysis of early Black contributions to American literature. He went on to compile and interpret outstanding examples of Black religious song, of the Black religious song form known as spirituals, and these renditions of Black voices formed the background for God's Trombones, a set of verse versions of rural Black, of like these sermons. Many critics regard this as Johnson's finest poetic work. The seven sermon poems, and they call them sermon, like sermon hyphen poems, so that's what they call like these poems in this collection. They were based on Johnson's recollections of the fiery preachers he had heard while going up, while growing up in Florida and Georgia, and were about the life and death, were about life and death and good and evil. They triumphed in overcoming the thematic and technical limitations of the dialect style while capturing a full resonant timbre.
Timbre, right?
No, it says timbre.
T-I-M-B-R-E?
T-I-M-B-R-E, yeah.
Timbre.
Great.
Sorry.
Cool. Critics also credited the poet with capturing the oratorical tricks and flourishes that a skilled preacher would use to sway his congregation, including hyperbole, repetition, abrupt mood juxtapositions, an expert sense of timing, and the ability to translate biblical imagery into the colorful, concrete terms of everyday life.
Wow.
This is a quote, and it says, "The sensitive reader cannot fail to hear the rantings of the fire and brimstone preacher. The extremely sensitive reader may even hear the unwritten amens of the congregation."
Oh my God, I got chills.
Yeah.
Just now. That's beautiful.
Isn't that so cool?
I want to read them right now.
Yeah. He received praise from prominent literary figures such as H.L. Mencken and Mark Van Doren for his efforts to preserve and win recognition for Black cultural traditions. He contributed to the spirit of racial pride and self-confidence that marked the efflorescence of Black music, art, and literature in the 1920s, known as the Harlem Renaissance.
Ever heard of it?
This period of intense creative innovation forms the central subject of Black Manhattan, Johnson's informal survey of Black contributions to New York's cultural life beginning as far back as the 17th century. The critically well-received volume focuses especially on Blacks in the theater, but also surveys the development of the ragtime and jazz musical idioms and discusses the earthy writings of Harlem Renaissance poets Langston Hughes, County Cullen, and Claude McKay. Black Manhattan is a document of the this is another quote. Black Manhattan is a document of the 1920s, a celebration with reservations of both the artistic renaissance of the era and the dream of a Black metropolis. Lots of amazing things.
Wow.
During, again, that decade that he was also serving as the executive secretary for the NAACP.
Super casual.
Yeah. Eventually, in 1930, he resigned from his position with them, being fatigued by the demands of the job. And
finally.
Yeah. And wanting more time to write. So he shifted to focusing more on that.
How old was he at that time, do you think?
Well, he was born in, what did we say, four pages back. 1871. So he was almost 60, right? To
1930.
1930
minus 59. 1871. 59, yeah.
Hey,
Matt. That's insane. Yeah. He was like I'm going to resign, but I'm not done working.
Right.
Yet.
I just need to do other things.
I'm just starting my creative life.
Yeah. Well, because then, too, so after he resigned from that position, he accepted a part-time teaching post in creative literature at Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee. So he didn't, like, just retire to go write. He still was, like, teaching. His last major verse collection, St. Peter Relates an Incident, Selected Poems, was published at some point. I don't know the year, but that was his last major, like, collection.
Okay.
He then died tragically in June of 1938 after a train struck the car he was riding in at an unguarded rail crossing in Wiscasset, Maine.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, so tragic death. His Harlem funeral drew more than 2,000 mourners.
Wow.
So lots of people that he, I mean, he touched hundreds of thousands of people's lives. Yeah. And then I just liked this closing to his biography on Poetry Foundation. Known throughout his career as a generous and invariably courteous man, Johnson once summed up his personal credo as a Black American in a pamphlet published by the NAACP. I will not allow one prejudiced person or 1 million or 100 million to blight my life. I will not let prejudice or any of its attendant humiliations and injustices bear me down to spiritual defeat. My inner life is mine, and I shall defend and maintain its integrity against all the powers of hell.
Oh.
Johnson was buried in Brooklyn's Greenwood Cemetery, dressed in his favorite lounging robe and holding a copy of God's Trombones in his hand.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What a beautiful life.
Yeah.
He did so much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He did so much. It's insane. And, again, I cut back so much. And, like, I would have normally, I try to have, like, multiple sources and all this stuff. But I was just like, there's just so much. And I want to be able to fit it all in.
Way too overwhelming. Yeah.
Yeah. So, gonna read one of his poems, which is actually interesting, because this poem sort of goes along with that time period we're talking about in the Harlem Renaissance, the 1930s to the 1940s. So it's a time when it was a little bit of a decline. It was a little bit harder for people, and especially artists and everything. The Depression was just happening and happened and whatnot. So, that's sort of what sets the tone for this poem. It is titled A Poet to His Baby Son, which I believe he had kids. I didn't even get to that part of his life. But yeah, so this is called A Poet to His Baby Son. Tiny bit of humanity, blessed with your mother's face and cursed with your father's mind. I say cursed with your father's mind because you can lie so long and so quietly on your back, playing with the dimpled big toe of your left foot, and looking away through the ceiling of the room and beyond. Can it be that already you are thinking of being a poet? Why don't you kick and howl and make the neighbors talk about that damned baby next door, and make up your mind forthwith to grow up and be a banker or a politician or some other sort of go-getter or whatever you decide upon, rid yourself of these incipient thoughts about being a poet? For poets no longer are makers of songs, chanters of the gold and purple harvest, sayers of the glories of earth and sky, of the sweet pain of love and the keen joy of living. No longer dreamers of the essential dreams and interpreters of the eternal truth through the eternal beauty. Poets these days are unfortunate fellows, baffled in trying to say old things in a new way or new things in an old language. They talk abracadabra in an unknown tongue, each one fashioning of himself a wordy world of shadow problems as a self-imagined atlas, struggling under it with punny legs and arms, groaning out incoherent complaints at his load. My son, this is no time nor place for a poet. Grow up and join the big, busy crowd that scrambles for what it thinks it wants out of this old world, which is as it is and probably always will be. Take the advice of a father who knows. You cannot be too young to not be a poet.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love that.
Right?
So much.
It's so interesting because it's obviously something, like, he wrote throughout his entire life, but it just goes to show, like, how much sort of the troubles of the time and the issues of the time affected him, and he was like,
on him. Yeah.
Yeah, And so, I just really love that poem. And again, it speaks to this specific time period in the Harlem Renaissance, but then also just speaks to sort of, I really like the style of it because it's a very frank thing and it's written sort of very, like it's not something to, it's not Heidi language or anything like that. Like you can just get it, but it's still beautiful to listen to. It's
incredibly flowing and it has a cadence to it.
Yeah.
That moves it.
Yeah. You get the sense of his musicality that he just sort of naturally has through it. So he does a really good job of using his musicality to sort of make it approachable and not sing-songy, but flow very nicely while you're just reading these sort of things, where if you were to just sort of look at it without maybe either reading it out loud or look at it in just like sections, you wouldn't necessarily know that it's a poem.
Right.
Or whatnot. But, so I would love to read. I haven't gotten to read his, the ones that are about like the spirituals and everything, but even just from this one poem, you can tell that he was just an incredibly powerful poet, but also I feel like you get a sense of him as a person too, and just the power that he had in terms of making change and sort of the passion that he had throughout life and in everything that he did and wanting to affect change.
Right.
In the age where he was functioning.
Thank you for sharing.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you for listening. I know that was a long one, but
no, that was incredibly interesting. He had a fascinating life.
An incredible historical figure that I had no clue about, and I'm sure many other people
also had no
school
clue.
Children and older don't know anything about and aren't taught about in history class. Yeah.
I wonder if my grandma knows him. Like of him.
Right, yeah.
Not he was, like knows him, but
yeah. Because he was like an active functioning person being in society and politics and everything while she was alive.
Right.
Yeah. That'd be very interesting.
I don't know.
Wow,
so amazing.
That is James Weldon Johnson.
Thank you for sharing.
Absolutely. All right. I think it's time for a break.
Yeah,
great. Everyone, let everyone take a little bit of a break, a breather, and we will be back.
Yay.
Woo.
And we are back.
We're back.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
We're back.
Hi.
I forgot to mention something at the top.
Yeah.
But guess who won the Booker Prize?
Oh, I mean, two people did.
Yes, for the first time in a long time.
Yeah.
First off.
Well, yeah, because it's against the rules now, technically.
Right. You listen to the same podcast I do. You know. But
we both
today,
it was
announced that Margaret Atwood won the Booker Prize for 2019 for her book, The Testaments, which is the follow-up, the sequel to Handmaid's Tale.
Mm-hmm.
So we have yet another accomplishment to place on her very, very well-decorated wall of achievements.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane.
Well, and who was the other person who won? I'm really interested in
the book that they wrote.
Yeah.
Me too, and I can't remember their name.
I'm looking it up literally right now. It's something woman something.
It's
Bernadine Evaristo.
Yes.
Is the other person. What's the name of her book?
Something Woman Other.
Yeah.
It's something, though. What's the first thing?
Girl, Woman, Other. Yeah. So
it looks so good.
Mm-hmm. It sounds very interesting.
I can't wait to read the Testaments, too. I'm very excited about it.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was exciting. That was just announced, either late yesterday or early today?
I think
it was on today's news, so it must have been yesterday.
It was yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah, big deals happening over there. So,
yeah.
Congratulations, Margaret Atwood.
Mm-hmm.
In case you're listening.
Congrats.
Okay. I have one very short poet for you today.
Great.
That worked out well.
It works out very well.
So here's how I found this poet.
Okay.
I decided I wanted to do, because it's our 30th episode, I was going in the theme of 30.
Okay.
And I wanted to find a poem that had the word 30 or the number 30 in it.
Cool.
In the title. Mm-hmm. So I found a poem called Whole 30, like the diet.
Uh-huh.
And I am going to tell you about its author, Kiki Petrosino.
Cool. Please do.
She sounded super familiar, so I was worried that maybe you had done her before, but I didn't see that you did. So
no, I did not.
Kiki Petrosino was born in 1979. Kiki is an American poet and professor of poetry. She was born in Baltimore, Maryland, the daughter of an African-American mother and an Italian-American father.
Mm-hmm.
She earned her BA from the University of Virginia, an MA in Humanities from the University of Chicago, and an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. So
all of the she's degrees. Just like,
I think I'll go again. Eh, I'll go again. It's insane.
Why not go again?
Sure. She currently teaches at the University of Virginia as a professor in poetry. And she has previously taught at the University of Louisville and Spalding University. She also spent 2 years teaching English and Italian at a private school in Switzerland, just as like a fun
side thing
that she did.
It was her gap year.
Gap years, yeah, exactly.
Oh my God.
Petrosino is the author of 4 books of poetry. They are Fort Red Border, Hymn for the Black Terrific, Witch Wife, and the forthcoming White Blood, A Lyric of Virginia, which is expected in 2020.
I feel like I've heard of Witch Wife.
Yeah, that's the one I'm going to read from.
Cool.
Her poems and essays have been appearing in Poetry Magazine, Best American Poetry, The Nation, The New York Times, Fence, Gulf Coast, Jubilat, Tin House, and other online publications like Plowshares.
Great.
Petrosino is also the recipient of the Pushcart Prize for her poem Monticello House Tour, which I had read, not knowing it was hers. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. She also is the recipient of a fellowship in creative writing from the National Endowment of the Arts and an Al Smith Fellowship Award from the Kentucky Arts Council. Her first book, Fort Red Border, is an anagram of Robert Redford, the name Robert Redford.
Hmm.
So Fort Red Border is Robert Redford. The book addresses themes of love, intimacy, food, race, and contemporary culture. The first section of the book is a series of imaginative lyrics spoken by a woman engaged in a relationship with Robert Redford, which is the name, or the reason for the name.
Wait, what's the word that you said? Anagram?
Yeah. So, like, you rearrange the...
You just... Okay. You rearrange... I knew it had something to do with, like, changing it.
Yeah,
but I was like, it's not backwards. Like, that's not... Robert Redford isn't...
Fort Red Border. No.
Oh, my God.
Like, okay. Tom Marvolo Riddle?
Yeah, no, yeah. I get it. Yep.
Yeah.
Continue.
So,
I don't know if you so saw funny. My face
I,
at all.
I did. You were like, what? Does not compute.
That was like that meme of the woman with the things just like flying past her face. That was me just now.
It really was.
Oh my God.
But yeah, like what an odd thing for her to write about for her first book, but also super cool.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like I said, it's... The first section of the book is this series of lyrics spoken by a woman engaged in a relationship with Robert Redford.
Great.
It's like, cool.
Just,
alrighty then. She must either really like or really hate Robert Redford.
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, did you see his Gatsby? It was awful. Just awful.
I didn't.
He's old.
Oh.
It's terrible.
Hmm.
Okay, so Rain Taxi.
Is he the person in Archer? No, that's no. Bert. No. Who the fuck is the guy in Archer? The, like, movie star guy that's in Archer? Robert Redford?
That's who this is. He's not him. It's not him.
Okay.
I really don't think it's... Who would he play?
The guy who's the mom's, like, boyfriend.
Oh, God, I... Highly doubt that Robert Redford is on Archer.
Okay.
Robert Redford, he might be dead. I don't know.
Oh, no. I mean, it's not the actual actor who plays him.
Oh.
Or maybe it is.
Okay, hold on. Now I have to look it up.
Do you know what I'm talking about, though?
No!
The guy who plays, what's-her-face's boyfriend?
Mrs.?
Yeah.
Is Robert Redford alive? He is! He was born in 1936. Great. Okay. Back at it. Yeah, so Robert Redford. Okay. Rain Taxi, which is a non-profit literary organization, commented on Kiki, saying Petrosino's speaker seeks to untangle sense, to make sense, to perceive and reveal in sense, and seeks to do so free of the trappings of an at-large hegemonic...
Burt Reynolds!
Jesus fucking Christ. Very different person. Very different Reynolds. Person.
Robert Redford. Found it.
Great. This is a shit show. Rain Taxi, a nonprofit literary organization, commented on Kiki saying Petrosino's speaker seeks to untangle sense, to make sense, to perceive and reveal in sense, and seeks to do so free of the trappings of an at-large hegemonic culture intent on bending her impulses to its will. Lots going on there.
Wow.
Petrosino also co-founded Transom, a poetry journal founded by herself and Dan Rosenberg. She served as the co-editor before passing her duties on to Beth and Bobby Rich. That's really all I have on her.
Great.
So the poem I want to do is called Whole 30. It's from her book, Witch Wife, as in, like, spooky witch, not like, quitch.
Witch not Wife. A witch.
Mm-hmm. Not a witch. which was published in 2017. After a winter of gluttony and grief, I'm back on plan for good this time. I've ballooned to a specific kind of ugly, the kind you hope to hide with body spray, but it gets worse after a winter of gluttony and grief. I've shown up for meatballs, for lemon whipped to weeping. Now I land my balloon for the specific kind of ugly salad oil is. Happy date night, darling. Happy coconut water and nutritional yeast. After this winter of gluttony and grief, spring comes, stabbing her hard stem of anger in the throat. Even garlic scapes are flat balloons, their ugliness specific as my penmanship. Green tubes of spice and hate. My body speaks the ugly testament that took all winter. It says, gluttony and grief balloon, darling. Only kindness is specific.
Hmm. Wow.
I just really liked it because it takes this weird turn at the end. I was not expecting.
Yeah.
It leaves me sort of unsettled.
Yeah.
Sort of like, what? Like, I don't know. It makes me, because like at first it sort of sounds like, oh, this is a woman who has kind of a negative relationship with her body,
mm-hmm.
but is like doing better and like gonna do more and whatever. And then it gets to the end and you're sort of still left with, but wait.
Yeah.
Like, what is it that she's
right,
saying?
Like, what are we... What are we actually talking about here?
What mm-hmm. is it? Is the whole 30 literally the diet
right.
that we're talking about, or is it like, are we detoxing our life mm-hmm. instead of our bodies? You know, or whatever. You
or
know, like
both.
What is she or both? You know, what is she talking about? Because gluttony and grief, yeah, I get. But then she starts talking about kindness, and I'm like, there's got to be missing stanzas here or something, right? Like, you just leave us with that. But I just really liked it. I thought that it was clever, and the way that she rhymes without really rhyming, I can never remember the name of that, like yeast, grief. They don't actually rhyme, but they have the similar sounds.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember that word either.
I love this line. The happy date night, darling. Happy coconut water and nutritional yeast. Like, just, yay.
Right.
Like, sounds awful. but I get it. Like, it's very relatable to me. this mm-hmm. poem. So, mm-hmm. I just really liked it. And I thought that she was a really cool poet.
Yeah.
She's got this really great look, too. Like, she's a very specific person. Mm-hmm. And it's very cool.
Awesome.
I can't wait for her new book. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's it. That's Kiki Petrosino.
Amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. That's pretty much it.
That went very well together.
We didn't even plan that. That was nice. Mm-hmm. Well, great. That's it for us. As always, we want to give a special shout out to Zach Adkins for our intro and outro music. Check out his new album. Last time I'm going to say it, but it's out now, January to June, on Spotify. It's very good.
Cool.
And as always, you can find a link in the bottom of our show notes that will take you to a support page where you can donate as little as 99 cents a month.
Dollar menu.
Donations, baby.
Woo.
And we really appreciate it a little bit. Goes such a long way. You have no idea. To those who have donated already, thank you very much. And those pennies and cents give us new microphones and a better place to record.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll someday pay for someone else to do the editing.
Right.
So Marguerite doesn't have to, even though she does a great job.
Thanks.
And as always, once again, rate and review this podcast wherever you're listening, but especially Apple Podcasts.
Makes you a can difference.
Give us those 5 stars. You know you want to.
Giving us 5 stars is giving yourself 5 stars because our audience is your audience, especially for those who say episodes. So the more stars you give us, the more stars you're giving yourself.
That's right. Do you think you're worth 5 stars?
We do.
We certainly do.
Give it to yourself.
So give it to us.
Baby. Uh-huh.
And with that, good night.
Good night, New York!
Live from New York! It's Millennial Poet Society!
No, I was doing that, was it like, Good Night, Chicago or something? Good night.